WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
You probably remember the story. It was almost a national obsession. In October 1988, three California gray whales were trapped in the Arctic ice. The rescue of the whales cost over $5.5 million, involved both the President of the United States and the General Secretary of the Soviet Union, and became one of the biggest news stories of the time. Tom Rose was one of the more than 150 journalists from four continents who came to Barrow, Alaska to cover the story. For Rose, the whales were a media-created non-event. His new book, Freeing the Whales, investigates the story behind the story, why these whales made headlines. Rose covered the story for a Japanese television network. His assignment was to cover the media itself and to explain the whale obsession to Japan, where whaling has been an historically important industry and whale meat a delicacy. I asked Tom Rose if reporting for Japan gave him a cynical bias from the start.
When I first learned of this whole adventure, I learned of it the same way every other American had. I learned of it by watching it on my television, and for the first two or three days, I was as enamored, as enthused, as excited to see these whales freed as anyone was. When I got the call from Tokyo and I heard my producer explaining our mission, so to speak, I said, oh my God, you know, I'm going up there to report for a bunch of whalers. Here these three whales are waging a magnificent heroic struggle to free themselves from the brutal Arctic elements, and I'm going up there to work for a bunch of whalers. It was only really after I got there and after I began to observe the goings-on of my colleagues and myself that the cynicism really began to emerge. And I wasn't the only one. We all, I think, felt exactly the same, that this was while at the same time one of the more interesting, remarkable, memorable experiences of our lives, it was also the most ludicrous news event that any of us had ever covered or most likely will ever cover.
Why do you think they became the lead story?
Because, first of all, people love whales. Here was an opportunity unparalleled in the history of television to see whales outside of a zoo in their natural habitat in really a magnificent fashion. All you had to do was open up your tripod, set it on the edge of the ice, focus and shoot. It was television journalism par excellence. There was no need for elaborate commentary. George Will wasn't required. It was simply television pictures. It was an image story, one bereft really of any news, but that doesn't seem to make much difference in this day and age, I'm afraid.
Who are some of the parties that you think used this story opportunistically?
I think the media did. I think the Eskimos did. I think the oil companies did. I think the environmentalists did, and certainly the Soviets did.
Okay, how do you think the oil companies did?
Well, the oil companies were at the time in the midst of a heated, nearly decade-long battle to open up the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge oil fields, which was adjacent to Prudhoe Bay. Environmentalists in Alaska had precluded them from achieving the Senate approval that they needed, and in October of '88, they were darn close to tipping the votes of the three or four senators needed to pass it. This was an effort to push those senators over the balance, to show that oil companies and oil executives were as concerned with the plight of endangered whales, or so thought endangered whales, as anyone else was. If they could prove that, if they could save these whales, if it would cost them $1 million or a reasonable derivation thereof, that's nothing. But 6 months later, when the Exxon Valdez struck Bligh Island in Prince William Sound, ANWR, the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge issue, was dead.
How do you think the environmental groups used this opportunistically?
They used it opportunistically to tremendous effect in Europe, more so than in America. Another irony was that one of the more remarkable offshoots of this story went totally uncovered in the American press. The government of Iceland at the time was one of four remaining whaling countries left in the world in defiance of an International Whaling Commission ban. Iceland had succeeded in thwarting a Greenpeace boycott in Europe for about 6 months. Greenpeace had launched this boycott in hopes of getting Iceland to change its whaling policies. For 6 months, it bore no fruit at all. Suddenly, these whales became news. West German fish retailers began to feel the heat of a suddenly reinvigorated boycott. Within a few days, the two largest grocery store chains in West Germany announced they would no longer do business with Iceland until Iceland ceased its whaling practices. And the government of Iceland was pitched into turmoil and nearly collapsed. 6 months later, or rather 9 months later, in August of 89, Iceland announced that it too was getting out of the whaling business forever.
It was a Soviet icebreaker that actually cut through the ice to finally free the whales. Do you think the Soviets acted opportunistically here?
Oh, they were the most brazen opportunists of all, without question. The two Soviet icebreakers that were working on the Polar Star Research Station, about 300 miles north of Barrow at the time, were given orders, strange cryptic orders from Moscow, to head south to Barrow, Alaska. They had been for 90 or 120 days, I can't remember which, but for many, many months, embedded in Arctic ice working on this research station, and the captains of these ships get this strange message to go to Barrow. They didn't know what was going on, so they go to Barrow, they follow their orders, they find these three whales, they cut about an eight-mile swath through the ice so the whales can swim free. They journey on their way back to Providenia, their home port of Providenia. The Russians emerge as the great environmentalists, the great heroes of this story, when in fact they were then and remain now the largest single killers of gray whales in the world, the very species of whales that were trapped. As a matter of fact, as these whales swam off, Soviet whaling vessels, subsistence whaling vessels that are armed with the fanciest equipment that wouldn't normally qualify under the definition of subsistence whaling, were waiting right offshore, that they might have possibly killed these whales themselves.
Well, you were there in Barrow in October of 1988 covering this story. You say at one point there was one reporter for every 17 residents of Barrow.
That would be like a million reporters crawling the streets of New York. Can you imagine that?
I'm sure that Barrow wasn't equipped with hotels and facilities and maybe even with food, with all the reporters that were there. Were there a lot of... how did reporters get rooms?
Well, there were a few rooms. There were two small hotels. I guess hotel is a euphemistic term for guest lodging in Barrow. Many of us, myself included, stayed at Eskimo homes on floors and on couches in driftwood shacks or in homes of local families. Now, of course, we had to pay most dearly for the privilege to the tune of, $100-$150 per head per night. None of us had any idea what we were getting into. Very few of us came up there with enough money. And it's a cash-only place, no American Express or MasterCharge allowed in Barrow. So we had to come with cash or, better yet, liquor.
There is an alcoholism problem in Alaska. How did you feel about using alcohol as a bribe almost to get rooms?
When I first got the call to go to Barrow, I picked up the phone and dialed Barrow. I dialed the 907 area code and then just asked for any number in Barrow because I had no idea where I was going or what I was doing. I finally, after a few calls, got a hold of this one fellow who was telling me what I said, well, what do I need to bring? What do I need to know? I'm leaving in 2 hours. He said, just remember this. Bring long johns and liquor, not necessarily in that order. Those are the two most important things. Well, it never really dawned on me why it was so important to have liquor. So when I got to Anchorage and met up with my crew that had come respectively from Tokyo and Toronto, we didn't really worry about clothing. We went to the nearest wholesale liquor warehouse and bought several hundred dollars worth of liquor. And it wasn't until the flight from Anchorage to Barrow that I was sitting next to a member of the Barrow School Board who was at a Native Alaskan conference who was telling me, an Eskimo woman, obviously, who was telling me about the ravages of alcohol. And there I am, and I've got literally hundreds of dollars worth of alcohol sitting in the overhead compartment above her head. I was shriveling in my seat to the point of wishing I could simply evaporate. I was so mortified in guilt.
So what did you do with the hundreds of dollars of liquor that you bought to take with you to Alaska?
Well, I'm proud to say I didn't, none of it was dispersed for that purpose, but perhaps not too proudly, I could say that it was all disposed of by ourselves. In a matter of 3 weeks, the press corps ourselves, we began to realize why Eskimos have such problems, because the sole objective in the Arctic, particularly at that time of year, the sole purpose for living is to stay warm, and one will do really just about anything to stay warm, and that oftentimes includes drinking.
Mm-hmm. You are still a practicing journalist.
Right.
What's the moral of this story for you when you go out to cover stories now, or when you edit other people's?
It was a remarkable transformation for me. I learned something that I would have never even fathomed I would have learned. Ever since Charles Darwin, really since the latter part of the last century, we in the West have been in a headlong rush to desanctify man. And the result is that today, anti-vivisectionists who march in streets in cities across the country saying that the value of the life of a rat is no less important than the value of the life of a human being is true. That is precisely what has happened, and the end result is we spend $6 million to save 3 whales trapped by nature, not by man. Animal life has now become as important as human life. I think that's a great tragedy, and I don't mean for an instant to say that these whales didn't deserve human compassion. It was simply not possible to see these whales and feel tremendous empathy for them and to want them freed. But what we seem to have lost our ability to do is to separate, distinguish, and to determine any sense of proportionate response for human compassion. If only humans could elicit the kind of compassion and love and tender care that we gave these whales, I think this world would be a much better place in which to live.
Tom Rose is the author of Freeing the Whales. This is Fresh Air.